friends. I'll close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome back to another exciting, or at least not overly boring, episode of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure.
We did that.
We did. We can say our names occasionally fairly well sometimes.
And it is November 8th where we are. And
no, we're not. It is not November 8th.
So I'm sorry, it's the 7th.
I'm just wondering why you started. All right, we're going to call the calendar by a different day.
Because I got this clock app on my computer, and it routinely gets the wrong day for some reason. I think it's
It has one job. One job.
It's not doing a very good job of doing that job, though.
No. And a stop clock can be right twice a day, but not if the day is wrong. Then it's just wrong all day. So this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And typically we talk about things like the economy, whether or not employment is good. Very, very exciting stuff, I tell you. It is the culmination of everyone's week. I am positive of this. We also talk about COVID-19 ad nauseum, but not as a symptom, the nauseum part that comes as its separate symptom of us instead of the disease. And we'll talk a little bit about the election. We'll be maybe the only people on the airwaves only talking a little bit about the election. We're going to cover the economy and what we think is ahead for us with what we know at the moment. Do you want to start the disclosures, or do you want to end the disclosures, or do you want to start and end the disclosures?
I can do whatever you want to do. I can tell you that we are an SEC registered investment advisor, as well as a radio program. And the SEC neither approves nor disapproves what we do. They're just the regulator that regulates us.
So the Personal Wealth Coach is the firm, and it's also the name of the radio program. And the firm is also an investment advisor, and it's also the name of the radio program. But it's SEC registered on the firm side, but that's just who tells us when we're wrong. It's not saying that we're right. It's kind of the opposite of saying that we're right. What we talk about here, even though we're an SEC registered investment advisory firm, off the air, is not considered investment advice. How's that for weird? It sounds like we're double talking already. The reality is, though, that investment advice has to be given to somebody that you know all about. If I'm giving investment advice to somebody that I don't know, it's kind of malpractice. So what do we do instead on the air? Well, we educate. This is educational content. We're hoping to provide you information that will allow you to make better decisions, whatever that may be. Even if they're not a decision I would make, hopefully for you, they will be a better decision than without the input. You want to hit the next one?
We don't pay for this radio program, nor does KTEM pay us to do this radio program. We do advertise on KTEM, and we pay for the advertisements, but we don't pay for the radio program, and they don't pay for us. They don't pay us.
They don't pay for us at all. Yeah.
No.
We get our information that we're sharing with you all who are listening, all three of you. Wait, do I include us in the count? I should say all one of you. Our information comes from sources that we deem to be reliable, but we do not, I'm going to do it your way, warranty or guarantee the accuracy or completeness of the information. The reality is, though, it's coming from good sources.
Actually, it's warrant or guarantee.
Yeah, but you usually say warranty.
I do?
Yeah.
If you say so, we can go back and check the recording. Anyway, the other thing is that we do try to get our media information accurately. We go for places like the Wall Street Journal, Associated Press, places like that to get our information. And it's generally pretty accurate, and it's generally pretty non-political, which is kind of weird, but that's where we are.
Yeah. That's kind of the way money is. It's the way the market is. And I know a lot of people have been terrified that the market was going to crash if fill in the blank was elected. But the reality is the same people that are voting, that are split so evenly that it's going to take us 300 years to figure out who won, are the same people that are investing, which means that we're evenly divided. That means half of us are going to be happy and half of us are going to be sad no matter what happens. So, and some of us in the middle are just going to shrug our shoulders and say, okay, let's go on. Yes. So do you want to cover the market?
Well, the stock market kind of liked the outcome as it seems to be unfolding. The ideal, and the economists have said this for some time, and market experts, whatever they are, have said this for some time, that a divided government is ideal. In other words, if the center remains in the hands of the Republicans and the president is in the hands of the Democrats, that's an ideal situation as far as the market is concerned, because it means there won't be any major changes. And as a result, that and the fact that it looks like we're not going to have a hotly contested election, which is something to bid worry the market, the S&P 500 index, otherwise affectionately known as SPX, rose a whopping 7.32% for the week, which is something like a record, the biggest jump since April anyway.
I have to throw this in here, though. You're going to say what it closes at, so don't lose your train of thought. But you often affectionately refer to it as SPX, but I think that tells the entire listening audience how nerdly we are. Most people do not affectionately refer to market indices.
Well, when I go to the doctor's office or the clinic or something, I say I'm affectionately known as November 5th, 1949, too.
Wow.
I tell them my name, and they always want to know my birthday.
Yeah. Well, happy birthday, because that was just a couple of days ago.
Yeah, it was. But it was a long time ago in election terms. The market closed at the S&P 500 closed at 3509.44, and that's kind of towards the upper end of where it's been. It's still about 2% below its high point in the beginning of September, and it is up almost 9% year to date. But in the bottom line to the reason it's up 9%, while the economy is still down quite a bit, the back to normal index at Moody's is still running at 81.5. Which means it hasn't moved, hasn't budged a bit. It's kind of stuck. The reason the market's up so much is basically 10 stocks. The 10 largest high-growth stocks in the S&P 500 dominate the S&P 500 stock index, and they are generally priced astronomically. So the fact that the market is up is really good. It's up 9% year-to-date is really good. If you don't happen to be invested in those 10 stocks, you're not seeing that. You're seeing, matter of fact, the median stock, and the S&P 500 is still down year to date, which makes sense because the economy is still down year to date. And one of the things that I think is very, very important to understand is that in the past, we can't tell you the future, but we can tell you that historically, when we've had a few major high growth stocks dominating the S&P 500 and trading at extraordinarily high price earnings ratios, we've had corrections to follow. Sometimes it takes several years for corrections to follow, but we do generally pay the price for that because it's just unrealistic to have the stocks priced that high.
Yeah, and when you say sometimes it lasts several years, a good way to know when it's coming to the end is when you just don't hear anybody talking about how traditionally this is not the role of a growth company.
Except us.
Right. And we're getting there. I'm seeing fewer and fewer headlines about big tech is overpriced and more about, look how great the market's doing. Guys.
The thing that we need to watch out for, and I have actually seen it, not this week because everybody's talking about the election, but running up to the time of the election, is when people start saying, and the news media begins to say, this could go on forever, this is the new normal, this is the way things are going to be, that these high growth stocks will continue to grow at high rates forever. There's an old saying on Wall Street, trees don't grow to the sky. There's a limit to how high a stock can go. And there's a limit to, for instance, Zoom is the easiest one to explain. Zoom has been selling a lot of copies of Zoom to a lot of people, and its growth has been phenomenal, and its price is ridiculously high. But eventually, the market gets saturated. There's only so many people that are going to pay subscription fees for Zoom. And once it pretty much saturates and people start looking at each other eyeball to eyeball again, Zoom is in for a real comeuppance. When it trades back at normal rates, it's going to drop a lot. I can tell you that with a great deal of confidence. Unless it finds some amazing new source of revenue that nobody at Zoom seems to know about or anybody else needs to know about. Back
to Can I give you the price-to-earnings ratio for Zoom?
Sure.
This is according to the Wall Street Journal. The price-to-earnings ratio for Zoom right now is 643.73, which means it would take the earnings that it's experiencing right now at the height of the pandemic, at the absolutely abnormally high rate, it would take 643 years of earnings like today to buy back the stock. Which, if you think back how far into the past that would be.
It's a sample.
Yeah, you're talking about prior to Christopher Columbus leaving Europe to today before the price gets paid back.
And some of you may remember this, but back in the dark ages, even before the internet, it wasn't before the internet, but it was a long time ago. There was a drink called Snapple, and it was wildly popular. And people started drinking a lot of Snapple. And there was an interesting commentary. This was during the stock market boom in the late 1990s, leading up into 2000 collapse. And Snapple was priced in such a way that literally every person in the world would have to drink at least a 6-pack of Snapple a week to justify the price. And, of course, you've heard so much about Snapple recently because it's gone. It no longer even exists. And that's the way these things tend to go. Microsoft,
you know why. It's because they drank it all up.
They obviously did.
Microsoft what?
Microsoft is not going to go away. Microsoft is still going to have good earnings. Zoom probably is not going to go away. Zoom is still going to be around. It's not like these companies are going to disappear. We're not seeing a situation like we saw in the year 2000 where the market was behaving very similar to what it was today because it was trading in vaporware in 2000. In 2000, we had like DR Coop and a lot of other companies that had no plan to ever become profitable, becoming large cap growth companies. They're gone now. But the companies that are dominating the market right now, by and large, are not companies that are going to go completely away, but they're kind of like the Nifty 50 of the, which probably nobody remembers except us. Back in the 1950s, there was something called the Nifty 50. There were 50 stocks.
The 1960s, yeah.
Well, back in the dark ages before the hills got dusty, back when I was young, there's something called the Nifty 50, and it's 50 stocks that if you own those 50 stocks, you can just buy them and forget about them. Most of them, they're easy to forget about now because you never heard of them.
They're gone. They're out of business.
One of them is Montgomery Ward's, which no longer exists, but it took a long, long, long time to no longer exist. Sears, Montgomery Ward's, the solid companies that you could depend on, U.S. Steel. They're companies that were absolutely consistent, absolutely always there, and would never go away. Well, most of them have gone away, but it took them a long time to do it. And the same thing is true of what we see today. You know, Intel is an example of something that there was a major shift in Intel this week. I don't know if you saw that. Intel is selling its chip-making facilities. Intel,
not selling them. They're discussing. It was a shareholder conference call, and the CEO said that there are three options. They either continue to manufacture 100% of their own chips, which is what they've done all along. Now that's one option. They're saying maybe they'll outsource some of their chip manufacturing and maybe they'll outsource a portion of individual chip manufacturing. And what does that mean? What is that? Because they're putting smaller and smaller pieces in the chips, and they are having trouble keeping up with the capability to do it. They've got a lot of sunken cost into their existing manufacturing capabilities. And to get smaller, they're basically going to have to start from scratch, which is what you're supposed to do if you have a new model, you start from scratch. But that's a lot of money that they're just going to have to write off.
It reminds me a lot of IBM and the PC.
Yeah.
The PC and IBM used to go together. It's IBM PC. And you had Apple, which wasn't talking about a PC for some reason, a personal computer. And then you had IBM. The IBM PC was the other standard. Well, IBM never thought that the personal computer or personal computing in general would take off, so they sold it all off slowly. And they finally got rid of it, and they didn't keep the software that ran it. And ultimately, IBM is shuttering and shrinking and in some degree of financial trouble.
And the little tiny company that they hired to write an operating system for this probably never going anywhere PC industry is now one of the largest companies on the planet, Microsoft, just in case
right.
You were wondering who that was.
So things change over time, and the stock market right now is focused on 10 very large stocks that seem to be like they're going forever. It is not a matter of when, it's not a matter of if, rather, it's a matter of when they suddenly come back to Earth. And it's something that may not happen for a couple of years. It may not happen. Nobody can tell when these things are going to happen. But the one thing I can tell you is that historically, those stocks that have traded at the high multiples of earnings that we have seen, the price-to-earnings ratio, which is multiples of earnings, have come back to Earth eventually. And when they did, it's generally quite surprising and it's quite uncomfortable, but it is the end of the world. In this case, like I said, I don't think they're Wile E. Coyote that's run off the top of a mesa and suddenly looks down and says, holds up the sign that says, oops, or something.
Yipe. Yeah.
Because the underlying economy has got a lot of growing to do, and we don't have the underlying economy collapsing underneath them. It's just that they are priced. Basically, the high 10 companies in the SPX, in the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, are priced so high because of the pandemic. And if you think the pandemic is going to go on forever and ever and ever, then they're priced reasonably, I guess. Well, not even reasonably under those circumstances, but it is going to come to an end. When it does come to an end, they're going to probably suffer some, we'll probably see a correction in that part of the market, while the rest of the market, the part of the market that's currently depressed, recovers very nicely as the economy does. It's going to be interesting to watch either way.
Yeah.
And the 10-year Treasury note slipped a bit, falling 6.83%. That's not a big deal. To 0.819% is the yield, which is a lot higher than it has been for the past several months, but it's lower than it was last week. Why? Because the 10-year Treasury note is fluctuating up and down right now based on the stimulus. And as it looks
or lack thereof, yeah.
But as it looks like we're not going to get a stimulus, the Treasury note yield is falling because it thinks there's going to be a lower demand for loans. Oil is at 37.41. It's up a little bit from last week, but it's below the magic $40 level. The $40 level is important because a lot of oil companies that are still not bankrupt need to have about $40 a barrel to turn a profit. It means they're below $40 a barrel, they're losing money. So it's pretty important that it get back up above $40.
And I want to just point something out. A barrel of oil is 42 gallons of oil.
Which is a crucial number.
Yeah, 42 is an important thing if you are at all a nerd like we are. And if you don't know what we're talking about, that's okay. But 42 gallons in a barrel, and a barrel is worth $37.41. You can see that it's less than a dollar a gallon of oil. It costs more than that to get the oil out of the ground.
And that's West Texas Intermediate oil. That's not the heavy, thick, cruddy oil that comes from some other places. West Texas Intermediate has a lot of gasoline in it, a lot of light distillates in it. And it's very easy to process. And
it's called sweet crude. And sweet crude, I don't know who the taste tester is. I wouldn't want to be that. That's not a job I want.
I think somebody went to refine and said, man, that's sweet, the amount of money we're going to make off of it.
I hope that that's the kind of sweet that they're talking about, because otherwise somebody's walking around with black stuff coming out of their mouth going, oh, that's pretty sweet. But anyway, you look at it, it's below the profitability line for a lot of the fracking companies in the United States.
Oh, one thing we haven't mentioned, our email addresses.
Oh, yeah. We need to get some. We don't have any open phone lines, and at some point in the future, we will. This is a promise. But if you would like to ask a question and have us answer it on the air, you may email us, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and that TPWC is for the personal wealth coach. If you're having trouble hearing the difference between T and P and C, Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie.
Ah, that's good. I like you said that.
I just like saying it that way sometimes. All right, so the Small Business Administration has come out and said to businesses that took more than a $2 million loan, they're sending out questionnaires demanding new details about their operations to justify the aid and loan forgiveness. So this is you know the old adage? There's an old adage, nothing comes from the government without strings, or we're the government, we're here to help you. SBA is filling its role properly. At first, we thought that they were going to be what the SBA has been traditionally, which is a small business help. And this free money is helpful. But the amount of time and effort in failing businesses having to be put toward the questionnaires and the changing rules, it's disgusting. It really is. This is a program that was devised to be helpful and has led to a lot of doubting on the part of small business owners. This is just kind of lay it straight out. It was promised, hey, nobody knows how bad this is going to get. If you need a loan and you use the loan to keep your payroll up and going, we're going to pay you back.
We're not going to make you pay back.
Yeah, you're going to get to, you keep it. You don't have to pay the loan. As long as you use it for payroll and some small amount for rent, we recognize this is a completely uncertain time. Nobody knows if their business is going to shut down or not. Everybody's business did shut down for a while. And now they're coming out and saying, now I need you to prove that you had true hardship before we forgive it. Well, that's a hardship in itself. And please get me clearly here. I don't think it's the role of the government to just give out free money all the time. But in a disaster, spreading out free money is an important role. You need to make sure that there's not fraud, that people actually have businesses and that they thought they were in trouble when they got it and that they followed all the rules that they needed to follow to get the forgiveness. But when you give someone a loan and say you're going to forgive it if they do these things, and then you just keep adding new things, that's generally called fraud unless you're the government. So I this is me again jumping in. I think we're the lone voices out here. When I talk about when the government gets fines from a big corporation like Wells Fargo or Bank of America or whatever, the government shouldn't keep those fines. It should give those fines to the people who were damaged, and that's why the companies were fined, but they don't. I just find that ludicrous. It's one of the funding sources for the government, so now that they can go out and do other things with it, please don't get me wrong. I know it's important for the government to go out there looking for crime, but you should be giving some of that back to the people that actually lost money. And when we're talking about any of this spectrum, a Small Business Administration needs to treat this the way Congress intended it. And it was bipartisan. I know since then, the Congress has become very, very partisan, but the CARES Act was passed with an extreme majority of both parties and signed by the president. I know we're all tangled up in the kerfluffle about election and how we can't agree about anything, including whether or not this paper is this color or whatever we're disagreeing on. But it needs to come back down to what was the intent here? And don't put extra difficulties on these businesses in the middle of extra difficulties. Do what you said you were going to do. I know that's not the role of government typically. I'm asking for a perfect world to have the government do what they claimed that they were going to do. But that's me again.
And I always said the original stimulus bill that came out of the House, just without regard to the size, had a provision in it that said basically if you borrowed less than $150,000, then all you had to do is say we used it for payroll and that's good enough. That's good enough, and it can be checked by the IRS later.
Right, and they've got a form that's sort of like that. And in the middle of this, just as a side note, a federal court just ruled that all the names of all the businesses that received an SBA Paycheck Protection Program loan is being released on a Freedom of Information request. And that's just a fascinating thing to me because, as far as I know, this is the first time that you can just go online and figure out what loans a company or a person have. So a lot of these loans went to sole proprietors, and now you can look up what they owe. And I realize we're trying to make sure there's no fraud going on here, but man, invasion of privacy, anyone, it's fascinating, especially when you think, all right, if there's someone that has a paycheck protection loan, that loan is directly tied to the size of payroll. You can find out a lot about, especially if they only have a couple of employees, you can find out exactly what they're getting paid. And guess what? Credit companies are already out there getting the information so that they can send based on what they expect your payroll to be to your company. So just information and letting it be open is important when we're checking for fraud, but it's also used by people that aren't checking for fraud. Just a heads up. Anyway, we can move on from the Small Business Administration and on to other subjects. I just thought we should cover both of those pieces.
Well, I thought it was interesting. News came out from Stanford University in a survey that found that 42% of currently employed workers in the United States are working from home.
Oh, I saw that. That's fantastic.
That's an amazingly large number. You know, you consider that the job hiring that's been going on is largely occurring in the manufacturing area. And you can't have 42% of the people working on the assembly line working from home. But the majority of workers in the United States work in the service area in some form. When you think of service area, you generally tend to think of restaurants and things like that. But, for instance, finance is considered to be a service. So the people who are working in finance, the people who are working at Google, down in Austin, Jake has a brother and I have a son who lives in a condo in Austin that looks directly over at the Google building. And you may not have known there was a Google building in Austin, but there's a big tall building in Austin.
If you don't know, you can do a search. You can go to, there's a website you can go to do searches.
There's a search engine by somebody, I think.
You can find that building if you really wanted to.
And it's empty. I mean, he can look in the windows, particularly in the evenings when there used to be lots of people working in there in the evenings because Google does run 24/7. And sure enough, there's lights on sometimes, but there's nobody there. You look in the daytime, there's nobody there, which is having a dramatic effect on real estate prices in major metropolitan areas across the United States. New York City is probably the hardest hit at this point. Manhattan business, rental business, or lease business is really hurting. You have a very large percentage, not the majority, but a very significant percentage of the leases that are simply not being paid. And, of course, then when they're not even being paid, what you do is you evict the people, but if they're not in the space, it's kind of hard to evict them. Actually, it's very easy to evict them if they're not in there.
Right. You just go in and close the door, and it was already closed. So, yeah. Now, let me throw in a piece here, if you don't mind, and that is that New York City has had a net positive on its population during this period, but the high-priced area has a net negative as far as people moving out of them and into lower-priced area. How's that for weird?
That makes a lot of sense, actually, because, again, it's a big shift that's going on in the United States. There are a lot more people working at home, and we know of people who have moved from metropolitan areas to smaller metropolitan areas or towns or some cases out in the country, and they don't intend to move back because they've discovered they can work from home more efficiently. Why more efficiently? Well, for starters, the average, the average commute in the United States is 45 minutes. I read it earlier.
I don't know those numbers, but man, that seems reasonable.
And if you save, that's saving an hour and a half a day, not to mention the gasoline and the wear and tear on vehicles and the frustrations that people have. But a lot of people have discovered that they don't need to commute. They can work out of a home office and just go on about their business and do just as well, which is one of the reasons Zoom is selling a lot of Zoom is being a very profitable company. It's because people discover they can see each other on computers just as effectively as they could in their offices.
Strange thoughts that we're actually getting to that Dick Tracy era where we just call each other on our phones and look at each other, or we pop open the screens, and people are actually getting better at working at home. There's less children interrupting them, and because kids by and large have gone back to school. So it's getting more productive, which is another number that we talked about in the newsletter that I think is maybe the most important number we need to be talking about, and that's productivity. Labor productivity rose 4.9%
in the quarter.
Now, I don't know how to emphasize how strange that is. Okay, so business output is down. It's down about 4% where it was at the end of 2019. But we're working 7.5% less time to be down 4%. The difference is productivity. We are more productive, and that seems to be increasing, not decreasing. During the big layoffs, we saw a big jump in productivity because you had fewer people doing more work. And now we're seeing increased productivity because fewer people are doing more work in less time. So that's a really, really good long-term benefit for the economy. That's a leading indicator. That means go ahead.
Big piece of this increase in productivity may be, and I haven't seen any direct connection between them, but what we've seen is as people work more from home, the productivity goes up. And that makes a lot of sense. Very frankly, people can work from home under circumstances where they wouldn't be able to come into work.
Right.
And I think we're seeing people generally having greater satisfaction working from home than they had working at work. And I think this eventually will reverse a little bit. Some people will go back to work at the office, but the productivity jump that we're seeing, 4.9% in a single quarter. Now, we had a big, like, 20% jump in productivity, as Jake was saying, in the second quarter as people were being laid off, and that's because there's a lag. You have the stuff in the system that's flowing out, and you have fewer people working, but that's basically a momentum lag in the system. But when you're hiring people back, and in the third quarter, we were hiring people back at a pretty high rate of speed. We've hired back about half the people that got laid off. And when you're hiring people back, normally productivity drops off because people have a little while to get up to speed. It takes them a little while to get to working together again. They're working in new environments where they're not infecting each other with COVID, hopefully. And normally that would cause a drop in productivity, but we saw And that 4.9% rise in productivity in the third quarter is pretty astonishing, particularly in light of the fact that for the last couple of decades, productivity growth in the United States has been between 1% and 2% per year. A 4.9% growth in productivity in a single quarter is earth-shaking. And by the way, we have a question. Did you get it?
I don't have it. Nope.
Okay. And let's see, it says sent from my iPhone. It's from Catherine. I was planning to build a new house in the next year. I'm concerned about the increase in the cost of wood right now and what the future may hold for the cost of wood. Is it a good time to build? And if not, how would I know when it would be? The building of the home would not involve a loan, so interest rate is not a factor.
This is a good question. Cost of lumber is up, and that's because of it's not really a housing boom. It's a renovation boom. People are buying lumber, and on top of that, so let me kind of give you another reason for it. 2 years ago, the price of lumber went way up, and a lot of people cut trees because of that. And it dropped the price of lumber drastically, and a lot of lumber companies were at a point where they weren't very profitable. Then the pandemic hit, and they said, we're not profitable anyway. Why are we still cutting down trees? So they cut way back. Our supply was very limited right when we had an unexpected demand. Everybody sitting at home looking at the same hole in the wall in their bathroom that they've been looking at for the last 5 years saying, I got to fix that. And now they can fix it. So isn't it amazing how everybody have the same hole in the wall in their bathroom that I just made up a moment ago?
Well, it is to do with holiness.
Yes. So, yes, the price of lumber is high. However, that shouldn't stop you in buying a house. It will add to the total price of the house, but on a much smaller percentage level than the new labor cost. Building a house, the price of lumber in the house, don't get me wrong, it's a big number, but a 10% increase in the price of lumber you may get a 2 or 3% increase in the price of your overall house construction because it's a smaller percentage of the overall price. The big chunk of the price of the house, and I realize this sounds weird, is labor. Another big chunk of the price of house is financing. So you've got to finance the thing with either a bridge loan or a construction loan or a single loan. The financing terms for that are generally about twice as much as a normal mortgage. When all said and done, when it's all finished up, you get twice the price in there. And that's a lot more than the increase in the lumber prices. And I know any price going up makes it more expensive. But you might want to consider looking at getting a quote from a contractor on it and comparing it to a previous quote. I don't think it's enough of a change to refrain from building at the moment, though.
And I think another thing that's important is, and this is going to get a little political, but it's reality. President Trump imposed tariffs on Canadian lumber, and it had been lifted. And that's caused an increase in the price of lumber because we import a lot of lumber from Canada.
That's on top of an existing set of sanctions on Russia. So if you're thinking about plywood, Baltic birch plywood comes from Russia. And that's much more expensive right now because we've got sanctions on Russia. We have a trade war with Canada and with the rest of the world. So lumber prices are high.
And presuming that Biden wins the election, I suspect he will pull that executive order off the table. I mean, he will rescind that executive order. There's really, frankly, there's Canada has filed with the World Trade Organization, although it takes years for them to make a decision, that is unfair that they weren't dumping lumber on the United States, and probably weren't. There's no evidence that they were, but we are basically in a trade war with Canada. If Biden wins the election, odds are he will end the trade war with Canada. There's really not a lot of point in having a trade war with Canada. What it's doing is making houses more expensive in the United States, and that's what the writer was talking about. One of the main reasons that lumber prices have gone up is because we have a 24% tariff on lumber coming into the United States from Canada, and that's enabled lumber producers in the United States to raise their prices 24%.
Yeah.
And expensive to build houses.
Yeah, and that's what happens with tariffs. It's an unfortunate thing, and every time new tariffs get passed anywhere in the world, there's this thought, well, we'll raise the prices on the stuff coming in from other countries so that our existing prices are being so much lower, everybody will buy their wood from us. if they're buying in the country, they'll buy the wood from the people that cut it down in the country. And that sounds great. Except there's not enough to go around. Unless they just increase their amount that they're cutting down, and we've got quotas on the amount that you, and if you're a company that owns the land, you know you can't cut down all your trees. This is something that goes back many thousands of years. Lumber has been, it is a long-term grow operation. You cannot change that on a dime or you're affecting yourself in 10 years. So high prices overseas mean your domestic prices rise as well. And I know that's not what we wish would happen, but that's what tends to happen.
And it is about time for us to do some commercials.
Oh, yeah. We're running late on commercials. I'm glad you said that. We're going to play some commercials. Say it again. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you'd like. It's about time to do some commercials.
All right. We're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email either Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. And after we come back, we'll talk about sales tax revenue to the state of Texas and where we are with that and lots more goodies. So Cooper, go ahead and play some commercials. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We've got about 10 minutes left this hour. We got a lot to talk about. I've got state sales tax numbers to talk about for Texas. What do you have to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about the labor statistics. Go ahead and on your sales tax numbers.
All right. This is going to be fascinating. Year to date, and this is October data for September. So we'll get November data for October soon, but it's not out yet. So we're talking about October's data for September, but year to date, the total payments are, this is sales tax revenue, are up for the state over the same period last year. Now, the last couple of months, they've been down. But the net is a positive. We are buying more in Texas than we did during the same time period last year. Now it's only by 0.04%.
But I think the Texas Attorney General is probably very, very happy that he joined in that big lawsuit to make Amazon and other places like that pay state sales tax.
But it could be. So that's a chunk of this, but they started paying that last year. So I think more people are paying online than they used to, but the sales tax revenue areas that have increased the most are the smaller towns. Big cities have had drops in sales tax revenue. Small towns have had massive jumps. So just hold that in mind. For instance, Nolanville here in Bell County is up about 40% over what it was last month. During the same month.
I think I know the reason for that. People used to go, for instance, in Nolanville, people used to go into Killeen to make their purchases.
Right.
Now they're probably making their purchases online from Amazon, for example, seeing Amazon's tremendous increase in volume. And so since their zip code puts them in Nolanville, Nolanville gets the sales tax, whereas right. Before getting the sales tax.
Now the year over year for our Central Texas location in Bell County, the smallest growth in revenue is for Salado, and which is just over 4%, 4.34%. That's a growth of 4.34%. A lot of the growth rates have been in the upper 20%. So our municipalities on the sales tax side are doing great. The property tax side is also doing relatively well. We may see some issues next year at the beginning of the year with property taxes in arrear for a lot of people. And that's something kind of across the country. You pay your property taxes at the end or the beginning of the year, depending on if you're trying to save a little money on the property taxes, but you're going to pay it somewhere between October and January. And there may be a lot of people that don't have the money to do it with. So we're watching that, and that's going to be one of those areas that Texas is going to be in better shape than a lot of other places, even though we're having an oil issue at the same time as everything else. You have something to add.
The Associated Press just declared Joe Biden the winner of the 2020 presidential election.
Wow. So they've come out and said it. That's really big news. Just checking a couple of, yep. AP says it. Looks like front page Wall Street Journal, Joe Biden is elected president, AP says. Kamala Harris is the first woman elected vice president. And Trump is contesting the results in key states. So we don't have both parties admitting it at this point, but it looks like the numbers add up.
The AP declared that Pennsylvania has been won by Joe Biden.
That'll do it. All it takes is Pennsylvania. It looks like Fox News declared it as Pennsylvania won for Joe Biden as well. Wall Street Journal. So we said we weren't going to talk much about the election, but we had the declaration of the winner right in the middle of our program.
Generally speaking, the Associated Press is the arbiter of who's won what state.
Right.
You know, Jake was talking about something before we came on the air that's important to understand. You think, why are these states taking so long to count when Texas declared very early? Well, Texas is still counting votes. What do you say? 97% of the votes been counted in Texas?
98%, yeah.
98%. But if the whole 2% has been counted, if every one of them were for Joe Biden, then Trump would still win.
Right.
So the AP declares Texas is solidly for Trump.
Right. And we've got 99% of the vote reporting in Pennsylvania. And there's probably going to be recounts on this, but as we've seen in the past, recounts don't change the numbers very much. They're pretty solid numbers at this point. And in Pennsylvania, 0.5% difference between Biden and Trump makes a big difference. So, I mean, it would mean the entirety of the 1% remaining would have to go for Trump for it to flip it, and that doesn't happen. So the AP says we have a new president-elect. Either way, this is a piece of historical context. This is historic. No matter what, we now have the oldest American president in history, the beginning of the second term or first term. Doesn't matter. Oldest president now. So.
Yep. Well, we have the oldest president. And we have the oldest president-elect.
That's right. And the older one of them is about to be the oldest president. So how's that for crazy?
Well, I think the next presidential election probably have younger people.
I think if they're the same age as the existing people, they will be older the next time around. So... So, yeah, even the same people will be older next time around.
Well, we haven't had an 80-year-old president yet, but we're working on it.
Yeah. I mean, you could have one no matter which way the election goes this time around. You might wind up with an 80-year-old president somewhere. Crazy.
And there's going to be vote counting, and there's still going to be a time period before the electors are officially instructed by the state. So it's not an official yet.
Yeah.
But it's in a position where, according to the Associated Press, who generally are the fair arbiters in this, the situation where if all the remaining votes to be counted went for the other guy, the guy they've declared winner would still win. So that pretty much, in essence, it's over at this point. But there's still counting left going on. So you can remain hopeful if you want to.
Right.
If you're President Trump.
And this is something, I had to... explain this recently to family members and to other folks. What's going on with the Electoral College? It's never official at this point. People are like, but other times when it's declared and you have speeches and yeah, it's the media that's declaring it right now. The Electoral College doesn't even vote till December 14th. They've got until December 14th to get their vote counting done so that the Electoral College votes can be cast on December 14th. That's the day that it's truly official that we have a new president elect. And the reason is because this is all done by the states, and each state sets up their own method for counting and whether or not they're going to go unanimous and all the Electoral College votes for this state get cast for one candidate or split according to congressional district. And the reason for that is so that the states have some say in the outcome of the election. This is a states' rights issue. The states get to say what's happening. So the federal courts can say, hey, this isn't constitutional. But it has to go by the state law. And if the state law is not federally constitutional, they'll say revise it. But otherwise, it's up to the states. And the states can say, they can, this is crazy, they can have their election on a different day. They can start their election whenever they want. Now, they have a deadline that says you can't do it past this date, and there's certain, you know, nobody's done it. So anyway, that's just a statement that